and she kept walking. His hair was gelled up in spikes, and his eyes were narrowed, like he spent his whole life squinting at things he didn't like.
I said, freak!
Tansy tried not to look at him. Her heart had begun to thump. She began to walk a little bit faster. He pulled forward a bit, so that she thought maybe he was going to go away, but he stopped the car and got out, and swaggered over so that he was in front of her, and she couldn't actually go any further without pushing past him. He leant to one side, like he was explaining something to someone stupid.
It's rude not to answer someone when they're talking to you. Did your mum never tell you that?
Tansy was so frightened that she couldn't talk. She just shook her head.
Where's your brother?
I don't know. Her voice came out as a whisper.
Yes, you do, you little four-eyed freak. Your brother thinks he's been a bit clever messing around with my Facebook.
He didn't, she said, but she was a really bad liar, and she knew as soon as she'd said it that he knew she was lying. He took two steps towards her.
You tell him that I'm going to have him, the cocky little shit. He thinks he's so clever. Tell him I'm going to mess with his profile for real.
The other Fisher, the cousin whose name she never remembered, muttered something to him that Tansy couldn't hear. They were all out of the car now, walking slowly towards her.
Yeah, Jason Fisher said. Your brother needs to understand something. He messes with something of mine, we mess around with something of his.
He lifted his chin and spat noisily on the pavement. It sat there in front of her, a great green slug. Tansy hesitated, not wanting to tread in it. She wondered if they could see how hard she was breathing.
Get in the car.
What?
Get in the fucking car.
No. She began to back away from them. She glanced around her, trying to work out if anyone was coming down the road. Her heart hammered against her ribs like a bird in a cage.
Get in the fucking car, Costanza!
He said it like her name was something disgusting. She wanted to run then, but she was really bad at running. Her legs always swung out to the sides at the wrong angle, and she knew they would catch her. She wanted to cross the road and turn back towards home, but she knew that as soon as she started to run, they would get her. And then a hand landed on her shoulder.
Look at her hair! You know about boys' four eyes? Course she doesn't know about boys. Look at the state of her. She's got lipstick on, the little tart. Still fugly, though. Yeah, but you don't have to look at its face, do you?
They started laughing. Her voice came out sounding like someone else's.
Just leave me alone. Nicky didn't do anything. We just want to be left alone.
We just want to be left alone.
Their voices were mocking. Fisher took a step closer, his voice lowered.
Just get into the fucking car, Costanza.
Leave me alone!
He started grabbing at her then, his hands snatching at her clothes. Panic washed over her in an icy wave, tightening her throat, pushing her heart against her ribs. She tried to push him away. She might have been shouting, but nobody came. The two of them grabbed her arms and were pulling her towards the car. She could hear their grunts of effort, smell their deodorant, as her feet scrabbled for purchase on the pavement, and she knew, like she knew anything, that she should not get inside. Because as that door opened in front of her, like the jaws of some great animal, she suddenly remembered an American statistic for girls who got into strange men's cars. Your odds of survival dropped by 72% as soon as you put your foot in that footwell. That statistic became a solid thing in front of her. Tansy took hold of it, and she hit, and she kicked, and she bit, and she heard someone swear as her foot made contact with soft flesh, and then something hit the side of her head, and she reeled and spun, and there was a crack as she hit the ground. Everything went sideways. There was scuffling, a distant shout. and she lifted her head and her sight was all blurry, but she thought she saw Norman coming towards her across the road at a speed she'd never seen, his teeth bared and his eyes black, looking not like Norman at all, but some kind of demon. And then there was a flash of red and the squeal of brakes, and all Tansy saw was something black flying into the air like a ball of washing, and all she heard was the scream, the screaming that went on and on, the sound of the end of the world, the worst sound you ever heard, and she realised it was her, it was her, it was the sound of her own voice.
Chapter 30. Jess. He was on the ground. Jess ran, breathless, barefoot, into the street, and the man was standing there, both hands on his head, rocking on his feet, saying, "I never even saw it. I never even saw it. It just ran out into the road." Nicky was on the ground beside him, cradling his head, white as a sheet, and murmuring, "Come on, fella. Come on." Tansy was wide-eyed with shock, her arms rigid at her sides. Jess knelt. Norman's eyes were glass marbles. Blood seeped from his mouth and ear. "Oh, no, you daft old thing. Oh, Norman. Oh, no." She put her ear to his chest. Nothing. A great sob rose into her throat. She felt Tansy's hand on her shoulder, her fist grabbing a handful of her T-shirt and pulling at it again and again. "Mum, make it all right. Mum, make him all right." Tansy dropped to her knees and buried her face in his coat. "Norman! Norman!" And then she began to howl. Beneath her shrieking, Nicky's words emerged, garbled and confused. "They were trying to get Tansy into the car. I was trying to get you, but I couldn't open the window. I just couldn't open it, and I was shouting, and he just went through the garden fence before I could get there. He knew. He went straight through it. He was trying to help her." Natalie came running down the road, her shirt fastened with the wrong buttons, hair half done in rollers. She wrapped her arms around Tansy and held her close, rocking her, trying to stop the noise. Norman's eyes had stilled, perhaps focused on some distant piece of food. Jess lowered her head to his and felt her heart break. "I've called the emergency vet," someone said. She stroked his big, soft ear.
"Thank you," she whispered.
"We've got to do something, Jess," he said it again more urgently. "Now." She put a trembling hand on Nicky's shoulder.
"I think he's gone, sweetheart."
"No, you don't say that. You're the one who said we don't say that. We don't give in. You're the one who says it's all going to be okay. You don't say that."
And as Tansy began to wail again, Nicky's face crumpled, and he began to sob. One elbow bent across his face, huge, gasping sobs as if a dam had finally broken. Jess sat in the middle of the road, as cars crawled around her, and the curious neighbours hovered on the front steps of their houses, and she held her old dog's enormous, bloodied head on her lap, and she lifted her face to the heavens and said silently, "What now? What the hell now?"
Chapter 31. Tansy. Her mother brought her indoors. Tansy didn't want to leave him. She didn't want him to die out there on the tarmac, alone, strangers staring at him with open mouths and murmured whispers, but Mum wouldn't listen. Nigel from next door came running out and said he would take over, and the next thing Mum was pulling her indoors, her arms tight around Tansy, and as she kicked and screamed for him, her voice was close in Tansy's ear, arms clasped around her middle. "Sweetheart, it's all right. Sweetheart, come on inside. Don't look. It's all going to be okay." But even as she closed the front door, head against hers, pulling Tansy to her, and her eyes were blind with tears, Tansy could hear Nicky sobbing behind them in the hallway, weird, jagged sobs, like it wasn't even something he knew how to do. And Mum was finally lying to her, because it wasn't going to be okay. It never could be, because it was actually the end of everything.
Chapter 32 Ed Sometimes, Gemma said, glancing behind her at the puce, screaming child arching its back at the next table, I think the worst sort of parenting is not actually witnessed by social workers, but by baristas. She stirred her coffee briskly, as if biting back a natural urge to say something. The mother, her blonde corkscrew curls cascading stylishly over her back, continued to ask the child in soothing tones to stop and drink its baby chino. It ignored her, possibly unable to hear her over the self-created noise levels. I don't see why we couldn't go to the pub. At 11:15 in the morning? Jesus, why doesn't she just tell him to stop? Or take him out? Does nobody know how to distract a child anymore? The child screamed louder. Ed's head had begun to hurt. We could go. Go where? The pub. It will be quieter. She stared at him, and then she ran a speculative finger across his chin. Ed, how much did you drink last night? He had emerged from the police station spent. They had met his barrister afterwards, Ed had already forgotten his name, with Paul Wilkes and two other solicitors, one of whom specialised in insider trading cases. They sat around the mahogany table and spoke as if choreographed, laying out the prosecution case baldly so that Ed was in no doubt about what lay ahead. Against him, the email trail, Deanna Lewis's testimony, her brother's phone calls, the FSA's new determination to stamp down on perpetrators of insider trading, his own check, complete with signature. Deanna had sworn that she had not known what she was doing was wrong. She stated Ed had pressed the money on her. She said that had she known what he was suggesting was illegal, she would never have done it, nor would she have told her brother. The evidence for him, that he had plainly not gained a cent from the transaction. His legal team said, in his opinion a little too cheerfully, that they would stress his ignorance, his ineptitude. That he was new to money, the ramifications and responsibilities of directorship. They would claim that Deanna Lewis knew very well what she was doing, that his and Deanna's short relationship was actually evidence of her and her brother's entrapment. The investigating team had been all over Ed's accounts and found them gratifyingly unrewarding. He paid the full whack of tax every year. He had no investments. He had always liked things simple. And the check was not addressed to her. It was in her possession, but her name was in her own writing. They would assert that she had taken a blank check from his home at some point during the relationship, they said. But she didn't, he said. Nobody seemed to hear. It could go either way with the prison sentence, they told him. But whatever happened, Ed was undoubtedly looking at a hefty fine, and obviously the end of his time with Mayfly. He would be banned from holding a directorship, possibly for some considerable time. Ed needed to be prepared for all these things. They began to confer among themselves. And then he had said it. I want to plead guilty. What? The room fell silent. I did tell her to do it. I didn't think about it being illegal. I just wanted her to go away. So I told her how she could make some money. They stared at each other. Ed, his sister began, I want to tell the truth. One of the solicitors leant forward. We actually have quite a strong defence, Mr. Nichols. I think that given the lack of your handwriting on the cheque, their only substantive piece of evidence, we can successfully claim that Ms. Lewis used your account for her own ends. But I did give her the cheque. Paul Wilkes leant forward. Ed, you need to be clear about this. If you plead guilty, you substantially increase your chance of a custodial sentence. I don't care. You will care when you're doing 23 hours in solitary in Winchester for your own safety. He barely heard her. I just want to tell the truth. That's how it was. Ed, his sister grabbed at his arm. The truth has no place in a courtroom. You're going to make things worse. but he shook his head and sat back in his chair. And then he didn't say anything more. He knew they thought he was odd, but he didn't care. He couldn't bring himself to look exercised by any of it. He sat there, numb. His sister asked most of the questions. He heard Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, blah, blah, blah. He heard Open Prison and Punitive Fines and Criminal Justice Act 1993, blah, blah, blah. And he sat there, and he honestly couldn't make himself care less about any of it. So he was going to prison for a bit. So what? He had lost everything anyway. Twice over. Ed, did you hear what I said? Sorry? Sorry. It's all he seemed to say these days. Sorry, I didn't hear you. Sorry, I wasn't listening. Sorry, I fucked it all up. Sorry, I was stupid enough to fall in love with someone who actually believed I was an idiot. And there, the now familiar clench at the thought of her. How could she have lied to him? How could they have sat side by side in that car for the best part of a week, and she hadn't even begun to let on what she had done? How could she have talked to him of her financial fears? How could she have talked to him of trust, have collapsed into his arms, all the while knowing that she had stolen money right out of his pocket? She hadn't even needed to say anything in the end. It was her silence that told him. The fractional delay between her registering the sight of the security card that he held, disbelieving, in his hand, and her stuttering attempt to explain it. I was going to tell you. It's not what you're thinking. The hand to the mouth. I wasn't thinking. Oh, God, it's not... She was worse than Lara. At least Lara had been honest, in her way, about his attractions. She liked the money. She liked how he looked, once she had shaped him according to what she wanted. He thought they had both understood deep down that their marriage was a kind of deal. He had told himself that everybody's marriages were, one way or another. But Jess... Jess had behaved as if he were the only man she had ever truly wanted. Jess had let him think it was the real him she liked, even when he was puking, or with his face bashed up, or afraid to meet his own parents. She had smiled sweetly, and let him think it was him. Ed? Sorry? He lifted his head from his hands. I know it's tough, but you will survive this. His sister reached across and squeezed his hand. Somewhere behind her, the child screamed. His head pulsed. Sure, he said. The moment she left, he went to the pub. They had fast-tracked the hearing, following his revised plea, and Ed spent the last few days before it took place with his father. It was partly down to choice, partly because he no longer had a flat in London that contained any furniture, everything having been packed for storage, ready for the completion of the sale. It had sold for the asking price without a single viewing. The estate agent didn't seem to find this surprising. We have a waiting list for this block, he said, as Ed handed him the spare keys. Investors wanting a safe place for their money. To be honest, it will probably just sit there empty for a few years until they feel like selling it. For 3 nights, Ed stayed at his parents' house, sleeping in his childhood room, waking in the small hours and running his fingers across the surface of the woodchip wallpaper behind his headboard, recalling the sound of his teenage sister's feet thundering up the stairs, the slam of her bedroom door as she digested whatever insult their father had apparently directed her way this time. In the mornings, he sat and had breakfast with his mother in the too silent kitchen, and slowly grasped that his father was never coming home. That they would never see him there again, flicking his paper irritably into straight corners, reaching without looking for his mug of strong black coffee, no sugar. Occasionally, she would burst into tears, apologizing and waving him away as she pressed a napkin to her eyes. I'm fine. I'm fine. Really, love. Just ignore me. In the overheated confines of Room 3, Victoria Ward, Bob Nichols spoke less, ate less, did less. Ed didn't need to speak to a doctor to see what was happening. The flesh seemed to be disappearing from him, melting away, leaving his skin pulled translucent over his skull, his eyes great bruised sockets. Death was claiming him. They played chess. Talking tired him, but oddly, he could play chess. He often fell asleep mid-game, drifting off during a move, and Ed would sit patiently at his bedside and wait for him to wake again. And when his eyes opened, and he took a moment or two to register where he was, his mouth closing and his eyebrows lowering as he took in the state of play on the board, Ed would move a piece and act as if it had been a minute, not an hour, that he had been missing from the game. They talked. Not about the important stuff. Ed wasn't sure either of them were built that way. They talked about cricket and the weather and the ridiculous cost of the pay-as-you-go entertainment system at the foot of the bed. Ed's father talked about the nurse with the dimples who always thought up something funny to tell him. He asked Ed to look after his mother. He worried she was doing too much. He worried that the man who cleared the guttering would overcharge her if he wasn't there. He was annoyed that he had spent lots of money in the autumn having the moss removed from the lawn, and he wouldn't get to see the results. Ed didn't try to argue. It would have seemed patronizing. "So, where's the firecracker?" he said one evening. He was two moves from checkmate. Ed was trying to work out how to block him. "The what?" "Your girl." "Lara? Dad, you know we got..." "Not her, the other one." Ed took a breath. "Jess. She's at home, I think." "I liked her. She had a way of looking at you." He pushed his castle forward slowly onto a black square. "I'm glad you have her." He gave a slight nod. "Trouble," he murmured, almost to himself, and smiled. Ed's strategy went to pieces. His father beat him in three moves.
Chapter 33. Jess. The bearded man emerged from the swinging doors, wiping his hands on his white coat. He paused in the doorway, like someone who had walked into a room and couldn't remember why they'd gone in.
"Norman Thomas?"
Jess had never considered their dog might have a surname.
"Norman Thomas? Large, indeterminate breed?" he said, lowering his chin and looking straight at her.
She scrambled to standing in front of the plastic chairs. "He has suffered massive internal injuries," he said with no preamble. "He has a broken hip and several broken ribs and a fractured front leg, and we won't know what's going on inside until the swelling's gone down. And I'm afraid he's definitely lost the left eye." She noticed that there were bright smears of blood on his blue plastic shoes. She felt Tansy's hand tighten in hers. "But he's still alive." "I don't want to give you false hope." His voice held the careful modulation of someone who had witnessed drowning men cling to the smallest pieces of driftwood. "The next 48 hours will be critical." Beside her, Tansy gave a low moan of something that might have been joy or anguish. It was hard to tell. "Walk with me." He took Jess's elbow, turning his back on the children, and lowered his voice. "I have to say that I'm not sure, given the extent of his injuries, if the kindest thing wouldn't be to let him go. But if he does survive 48 hours... then he may stand some chance of recovery. But as I said, Mrs. Thomas, I don't want to give you false hope. He really isn't a well lad." Around them, the waiting clients were watching silently, their cats in pet carriers cradled on their laps, their small dogs panting gently under chairs. Nicky was staring at the vet, his jaw set in a tense line. His mascara was smudged around his eyes. "And if we do proceed, it's not going to be cheap. He may need more than one operation, possibly even several. Is he insured?" Jess shook her head. Now the vet became awkward. "I need to warn you that going forwards, his treatment is likely to cost a significant sum. and there are no guarantees of recovery. It's very important that you understand that before we go any further.
It was her neighbour, Nigel, who had saved him. He had run from his house carrying two blankets, one to wrap around the shivering Tansy, the other to cover the body of the dog. "Go indoors," he had instructed Jess. "Take the kids indoors." But as he drew the tartan rug gently over Norman's head, he had paused and said to Natalie, "Did you see that?" She hadn't heard him at first, over the sound of the crowd and Tansy's muffled wailing and the children crying nearby, because even though they didn't know him, they understood the utter sadness of a dog lying motionless in the road. "Natalie, his tongue, look. I think he's panting. Here, pick him up. Get him in the car, quick." It had taken three of Jess's neighbours to lift him. They had laid him carefully on the rear seat and had driven in a blur to the big veterinary practice on the outskirts of town. It wasn't as quick as Mr. Miller by the crossroads, but they had an operating theatre and hotlines to all sorts of specialists. Natalie had cradled Norman on the back seat, crouching in the footwell so that she could support his head. Jess loved Nigel for not once mentioning the blood all over his upholstery. They had wrung her from the vets and told her to get down there as fast as she could. Under her jacket, she was still in her pyjamas. "So, what do you want to do?" Lisa Ritter had once told Jess about a huge deal her husband had done that had gone wrong. "Borrow $5,000 and you can't pay it back and it's your problem," she said, quoting him. "Borrow $5 million and it's the bank's problem." Jess looked at her daughter's pleading face. She looked at Nikki's raw expression. The grief and love and fear that he finally felt able to express. She was the only person who could make this right. She was the only person who would ever be able to make it right. "Do whatever it takes," she said. "I'll find the money. Just do it." The short pause told her he thought she was a fool, but of a kind he was well used to dealing with. "Come this way, then," he said. "I need you to sign some paperwork." Nigel drove them home. She tried to give him some money, but he waved her away gruffly and said, "What are neighbours for?" Belinda cried as she came out to greet them. "We're fine," she muttered dully, her arm around Tansy, who still shook intermittently. "We're fine, thank you." They would call, the vet said, if there was any news. Jess didn't tell the kids to go to bed. She wasn't sure she wanted them to be alone in their rooms. She locked the door, bolted it twice, put an old film on. She went round the house and secured every window, drawing the curtains and propping a chair underneath the back door handle just for good measure. Then she made three mugs of cocoa, brought her duvet down and sat under it, one child on each side of her, watching television that they didn't see, each alone with their thoughts, praying, praying that the telephone wouldn't ring.
Chapter 34. Nikki. This is the story of a family who didn't fit in. A little girl who was a bit weird and geeky and liked maths more than makeup, and a boy who liked makeup and didn't fit into any tribes. And this is what happens to families who don't fit in. They end up broken and skint and sad. No happy ending here, folks. Mum doesn't stay in bed anymore, but I catch her wiping her eyes as she washes up or gazing down at Norman's basket. She's busy all the time, working, cleaning, sorting out the house. She does it with her head down and her jaw set. She packed up three whole boxes of her paperback books and took them back to the charity shop because she said she'd never have time to read them, and besides, it's pointless believing in fiction. I miss Norman. It's weird how you can miss something you only ever complained about. Our house is weirdly quiet without him. But since the first 48 hours went past, and Mr. Adamson said he was in with a chance, and we all cheered down the phone, I've started to worry about other stuff. We sat on the sofa last night after Tansy went to bed, and the phone still didn't ring. Then I said to Mum, "So what are we going to do?" She looked up from the television. I mean, if he lives. She let out a long breath, like this was something that had already occurred to her. And then she said, "You know what, Nikki? We didn't have a choice. He's Tansy's dog, and he saved her. If you don't have a choice, then it's actually quite simple." I could see that even though she really did believe this, and it might actually be quite simple, the extra debt is like a new weight settling on her. That with each new problem, she just looks a bit older and flatter and wearier. She doesn't talk about Mr. Nichols. I couldn't believe after how they'd been together that it could just end like that. Like one minute you could seem really happy and then nothing. "I thought you got all that stuff sorted when you get older. But clearly you don't. So that's something else to look forward to." I walked up to her then, and I gave her a hug. And that might not be a big deal in your family, but I can tell you in mine it is. It's about the only stupid difference I can make. So this is the thing I don't understand. I don't understand how our family can basically do the right thing and yet always end up in the crap. I don't understand how my little sister can be brilliant and kind and some sort of damn genius, and yet pretty much everything she loves has disappeared. Just because she's a bit different. I don't understand how it is now that she wakes up crying and having nightmares and I have to lie awake listening to Mum pottering across the landing at 4 a.m, trying to calm her down. And how she stays inside in the day, even though it's finally warm and sunny, because she's too afraid to go outside anymore in case the fishes come back to get her. And how in 6 months' time she'll be at a school whose main message is that she should be like everyone else or she gets her head kicked in, like her freak of a brother did. I think about Tansy without maths, and it just feels like the whole universe has gone mad. It's like Morecambe without Wise, or Jaffa Cakes without the orange. I just can't imagine who Tans will even be if she doesn't do maths anymore. I don't understand why I just got used to sleeping, and now I lie awake listening for non-existent sounds downstairs, and how now, when I want to go to the shop to buy a paper or some sweets, I feel sick again, and have to fight the urge to look over my shoulder. I don't understand how a big, useless, soppy dog, who has basically never done anything worse than dribble on everyone, had to lose an eye and get his insides rearranged just because he tried to protect the person he loves. Mostly, I don't understand how the bullies and the thieves and the people who just destroy everything, the arseholes, get away with it. The boys who punch you in your kidneys for your dinner money, and the police who think it's funny to treat you like you're an idiot. And the kids who take the piss out of anyone who isn't just like them, whether they're posh and at a maths competition, or a stupid, ignorant idiot who doesn't know the difference between a username and a password. Or the dads who walk right out and just start afresh somewhere new that smells of Febreze with a woman who drives her own Toyota and owns a three-piece with no marks on it and laughs at all their stupid jokes like they're God's gift and not actually a slime ball who lied to all the people who loved him for 2 whole years. 2 whole years. I'm sorry if this blog has just got really depressing, but that's how our life is right now. My family, the eternal losers. It's not a story, really, is it? It's a flipping cautionary tale. Mum always told us that good things happen to good people. Guess what? She doesn't say that anymore.
Chapter 35. Jess. The police came on the fourth day after Norman's accident. Jess watched the officer coming up the garden path through the living room window, and for one stupid minute she thought she had come to tell her Norman had died. A young woman, red hair pulled back in a neat ponytail, one Jess hadn't seen before. She was coming in response to reports about a road traffic accident, she said, as Jess opened the door. Don't tell me, Jess said, walking back down the hall to the kitchen. The driver's going to sue us for damaging his car. It was Nigel who had warned her this might happen. She had actually started to laugh when he said it. The officer looked at her notebook. Well, not at the moment, at least. The damage to his car seems to be minimal, and there have been conflicting statements as to whether he was exceeding the speed limit. But we've had various reports about what happened in the lead-up to the accident, and I was wondering if you could clarify a few things.
What's the point? Jess said, turning back to the washing up. You lot never take any notice. She knew how she sounded. Like half the residents of this estate. Antagonistic. Braced for confrontation. Hard done by. She no longer cared. But the officer was too new, too keen to play that game. Well, do you think you could tell me what happened anyway? I'll only take 5 minutes of your time. So Jess told her. In the flat tones of someone who no longer expected to be believed, she told her about the Fishers and their history with them, and the fact that she now had a daughter who was afraid to play in her own garden, even though Jess had repaired the hole in the fence. She told her about her daft, cow-sized dog, who was racking up bills at the vet's roughly equivalent to if she had bought him a suite in a luxury hotel. She told her how her son's sole aim now was to get as far from this town as possible, and how, thanks to the Fishers having made a misery of his exam year at school, this was unlikely to happen. The officer didn't look bored. She stood leaning against the kitchen cabinets and taking notes. Then she asked Jess to show her the fence. Jess didn't bother going outside. There, she said, pointing through the window. You can see where I've mended it by the lighter wood. And the accident, if that's what we're calling it, happened about 50 yards up on the right. She watched her walk outside and turned back to the sink. Aileen Trent, pulling her shopping trolley, gave her a cheery wave over the hedge. Then when she registered who was in the garden, she ducked her head and walked swiftly the other way. P.C. Kenworthy was out there for almost 10 minutes. Jess almost forgot about her. She was unloading the washing machine when the officer let herself back in. "Can I ask you a question, Mrs. Thomas?" she said, closing the back door behind her. "That's your job," Jess said. "You've probably been through this a dozen times already, but your CCTV camera, does it have any film in it?" Jess watched the footage 3 times after PC Kenworthy called her into the station, sitting beside her on a plastic chair in Interview Suite 3. It chilled her every time. The tiny figure, her sequined sleeves glinting in the sun, walking slowly along the edge of the screen, pausing to push her spectacles up her nose. The car that slows. The door that opens. 1, 2, 3 of them. Tansy's body language, the slight step backwards, the nervous glance behind, back down the road, the raised hands. And then they're on her, and just cannot watch.
I'd say that was pretty conclusive evidence, Mrs. Thomas, and on good quality footage. The Crown Prosecution Service will be delighted, she said cheerfully, and it took Jess several seconds to grasp that she meant this, that somebody was actually taking them seriously. At first, Fisher had denied it, of course. He said they were having a joke with Tansy. But we have her testimony, and 2 witnesses who have come forward, and we have screenshots of Jason Fisher's Facebook account discussing how he was going to do it. Do what? Her smile faded for a minute. Something not very nice to your daughter. Jess didn't ask anything else. They had received an anonymous tip that he used his name as his password. The Egypt, PC Kenworthy said. She actually said Egypt. Between us, she said as she let Jess out. That hacked evidence may not be strictly admissible in court, but let's just say it gave us a leg up. The case was reported in vague terms at first. Several local youths, the local paper said, arrested for assault of a minor and attempted kidnap. But they were in the papers again the following week, and named. Apparently, the Fisher family had been instructed to move out of their council house. The Thomases were not the only people they had been harassing. The Housing Association was quoted as saying the family had long been on a last warning. Nicky held up the local newspaper over tea, and he read the story aloud. They were all silent for a moment, unable to believe what they had heard. It actually says the Fishers have to move somewhere else. That's what it says, Nicky said. But what will happen to them? Jess said, her fork still halfway to her mouth. Well, it says here they're going to move to Surrey, to near his brother-in-law. Surrey? But they're not the Housing Association's responsibility anymore. None of them. Jason Fisher and his cousin and his family. They're moving in with some uncle, and even better, there's an exclusion order preventing them from returning to the estate. Look,
There's two pictures of his mum crying and saying they've always been misunderstood and Jason wouldn't hurt a fly. He pushed the newspaper across the table towards her. Jess read the story twice, just to check he'd understood it correctly, that she'd understood it correctly. They actually get arrested if they come back here. See, Mum, he said, chewing on a piece of bread. You were right. Things can change. Jess sat very still. She looked at the newspaper, then back at him, until he realised what he had called her. And she could see him colouring, hoping she wouldn't make a big deal out of it. So she swallowed and then she wiped both her eyes with the heels of her palms and stared at her plate for a minute before she began eating again. Right, she said, her voice strangled. Well, that's good news. Very good news. Do you really think things can change? Tandy's eyes were big and dark and wary. Jess put down her knife and fork. I think I do, love. I mean, we all have our down moments, but yes, I do. And Tansy looked at Nicky and back at Jess. And then she carried on eating. Life went on. Jess walked to the Feathers on a Saturday lunchtime, hiding her limp for the last 20 yards and pleaded for her job back. Des told her he'd taken on a girl from the city of Paris.
Not the actual city of Paris. That would be uneconomical.
Can she take apart the pumps when they go wrong? Jess said. Will she fix a cistern in the men's loos?
Des leant on the bar. Probably not, Jess.
He ran a chubby hand through his mullet.
But I need someone reliable.
You're not reliable.
Give me a break, Des.
One missed week in 2 years. Please, I need this. I really need this.
He said he'd think about it. The children went back to school. Tansy wanted Jess there to pick her up every afternoon. Nicky got up without her having to go in 6 times to wake him. He was actually eating breakfast when she got out of the shower. He didn't ask to renew his prescription of anti-anxiety medication. The flick on his eyeliner was point perfect.
I was thinking I might want to do sixth form at MacArthur's after all, and then, you know, I'll be around when Tansy starts big school.
Jess blinked. That's a great idea. She cleaned alongside Natalie, listening to her gossip about the final days of the Fishers, how they had pulled every plug socket off the walls and kicked holes in the plaster in the kitchen before they'd left the house on Pleasant View. Someone, she pulled a face, had set fire to a mattress outside the Housing Association office on Sunday night.
You must feel relieved, though, eh? She said.
Sure, Jess said. Natalie straightened and rubbed her back.
I meant to ask you, what was it like going all the way to Scotland with Mr. Nichols? It must have been weird.
Jess leant over the sink and paused, gazing out of the window at the infinite crescent of the sea.
It was fine.
Didn't you run out of things to say to him stuck in that car? I know I would. Jess's eyes prickled with tears so that she had to pretend to be scrubbing at an invisible mark on the stainless steel.
No, she said, funnily enough. I didn't. Here was the thing.
Jess felt the absence of Ed like a thick blanket, smothering everything. She missed his smile, his lips, his skin, the bit where a trace of soft dark hair snaked up towards his belly button. She missed feeling like she had when he was there, that she was somehow more attractive, more sexy, more everything. She missed feeling as if anything was possible. She couldn't believe losing someone you had known such a short time could feel like losing a part of yourself, that it could make food taste wrong and colours seem dull. Jess saw now that when Marty had left, everything she had felt had been related to practical matters. She had felt unsafe. She had worried about how the children would feel with him gone. She had worried about money, about who would mind them if she had to do an evening shift at the pub, about who would take the bins out on a Thursday. But what she mostly felt was a vague relief. Ed was different. Ed's absence was a kick in the guts first thing in the morning, a black hole in the dead of night. Ed was a constant running conversation in the back of her mind.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean...
I love you. More than anything, she hated the fact that a man who had seen only the best of her now thought the worst. To Ed, she was now no better than any of the other people who had let him down or messed him up. In fact, she was probably worse. And it was all her own fault. That was the thing she could never escape from. It was entirely her own fault. She thought about it for 3 nights. Then she wrote him a letter. So, in one ill-thought-out minute, I became the person I have always taught my children not to be. We are all tested eventually, and I failed. I'm sorry. I miss you. P.S. I know you'll never believe me, but I was always going to pay it back. She put her phone number on it, and £20 in an envelope marked First Installment. And she gave it to Natalie, and asked her to put it with his post at beachfront reception. The next day, Natalie said a for sale sign had gone up outside number 2, and she watched her reaction just slightly too closely, and then she stopped asking questions about Mr. Nichols. When 5 days had gone by, and Jess realized he wasn't going to respond, she spent an entire night awake. And then she told herself firmly that she could lie around feeling miserable no longer. It was time to move on. Heartbreak was a luxury too costly for the single parent. On Monday, she made herself a cup of tea, sat down at the kitchen table, and called the credit card company. She was told that she needed to up her minimum monthly payment. She opened a letter from the police, who said that she would be fined £1,000 for driving without tax and insurance, and that if she wanted to appeal against the penalty, she should apply for a court hearing in the following ways. She opened the letter from the Pound, which said she owed £120 up to the previous Thursday for the safekeeping of the rolls. She opened the first bill from the vet and shoved it back in the envelope. There was only so much news you could digest in one day. She got a text from Marty, who wanted to know if he could come and see the kids at half term. "What do you think?" she said to them over breakfast. They shrugged. After her cleaning shift on Tuesday, she walked into town to the low-cost solicitors and paid them £25 to draft a letter to Marty asking for a divorce and for back payments in child support. "How long?" the woman asked.
2 years.
She didn't even look up. Jess wondered what kinds of stories she heard every day. She tapped him some figures, then turned the screen to Jess's side of the desk. "That's what it comes to. Quite a sum. He'll ask to pay in installments. They usually do."
"Fine."
Jess reached for her bag.
"Do what you have to do."
She worked her way methodically through the list of things she needed to sort out, and she tried to see a bigger picture beyond that small town. Beyond a little family with financial problems and a brief love story that had snapped in two before it had really begun. Sometimes, she told herself, life was a series of obstacles that just had to be negotiated, possibly through a sheer act of will. She stared out at the muddy blue of the endless sea, gulped in the air, lifted her chin, and decided that she could survive this. She could survive most things. It was nobody's right to be happy, after all. Jess walked along the pebbly beach, her feet sinking, stepping over the groins, and counting her blessings on 3 fingers, as if she was playing a piano in her pocket. Tansy was safe. Nicky was safe. Norman was getting better. That was what it all boiled down to in the end, wasn't it? The rest was just detail. If she said it often enough, she might start believing it. 2 evenings later, they sat in the garden on the old plastic furniture. Tansy had washed her hair and was on Jess's lap, while Jess tugged the comb through the wet tangles. She told them why Mr. Nichols wouldn't be coming back. Nicky stared at her.
From his pocket?
No, it had fallen out of his pocket. It was in a taxi, but I knew whose it was. There was a shocked silence. Jess couldn't see Tansy's face. She wasn't sure she wanted to look at Nicky's. She kept combing gently, smoothing her daughter's hair, her voice calm and reasonable, as if that might bring reason to what she had done. What did you do with the money? Tansy's head had become unusually still. Jess swallowed. I can't remember now. Did you use it for my registration? She kept combing. Smooth and comb. Tug, tug, release. I honestly can't remember, Tansy. Anyway, what I did with it is irrelevant. Jess could feel Nikki's eyes on her the whole time she spoke. So why are you telling us now? Tug, smooth, release. Because I want you to know that I made a terrible mistake and I'm sorry. Even if I planned to pay it back, I should never have taken that money. There was no excuse for it. And Ed, Mr. Nichols, was well within his rights to leave when he found out because, well, the most important thing you have with another human being is trust. She tried to keep her voice measured and unemotional. It was becoming harder. So, I want you to know that I'm sorry I let you both down. I'm conscious that I've always told you how to behave, and then I did the complete opposite. I'm telling you because not telling you would make me a hypocrite. But I'm also telling you because I want you to see that doing the wrong thing has a consequence. In my case, I lost someone I cared about. Very much. They were both silent. After a minute, Tansy reached a hand round. Her fingers sought Jess's, then closed briefly around them. It's okay, Mum, she said. We all make mistakes. Jess closed her eyes. When she opened them again, Nikki lifted his head. He looked genuinely bemused. He would have given it to you, he said. There was a faint but unmistakable trace of anger in his voice. Jess stared at him. He would have given it to you, if you'd asked. Yes, she said, her hand stilled on Tansy's hair. Yes. That's the worst bit. I think he probably would have done.
Chapter 36. Nikki. A week went by. They caught the bus to see Norman every day. The vet had sewn up his eye socket where the eye had had to be taken out. There wasn't an actual hole, but it still looked pretty grim. The first time Tansy saw his face, she burst into tears. They said he might bump into things for a while once he was up and about. They said he would spend a lot of time sleeping. Nikki didn't like to tell him he wasn't sure anyone would be able to tell the difference. Jess stroked his head and told him he was a wonderful, brave boy. And when his tail thumped gently on the tile floor of his veterinary pen, she blinked a lot and turned away. On the Friday, Jess asked Nikki to wait in reception with Tansy, and she walked over to the front desk to speak to the woman about the bill. He guessed it was about the bill. They printed out a sheet of paper, then a second sheet, then incredibly a third, and she ran her finger the whole way down each page and swallowed visibly when it reached the bottom. They had walked home that day, even though Jess was still limping. The town started to get busier as the sea turned from mucky grey to glinting blue. It felt weird at first, the fishers being gone. It was as if no one could actually believe it. Someone said that they'd gone to Sussex, not Surrey. Someone else said that Fisher's dad had been arrested for aggravated assault in Northampton. Nobody's tyres got slashed. Mrs. Warboys started to walk to bingo in the evenings again. Nikki got used to being able to walk to the shop and back and realised the butterflies he still felt in his stomach didn't have to be there. He told them this repeatedly, but they refused to get the message. Tansy didn't come outside at all unless Jess was with her. Nikki didn't look at his blog for almost 10 days. He had written that post when Norman was hurt, and he was so full of anger that he had had to get it out somewhere. He had never felt rage. Real rage, where he had wanted to break stuff and hit people before, but for days after the fishers had done what they did, Nikki felt it. It boiled in his blood like poison. It made him want to scream. For those awful few days at least, writing it down and putting it out there had actually helped. It had felt like he was telling someone, even though that someone didn't really know who he was and probably didn't care. He just needed to know that someone would hear what had happened, would see the injustice of it. And then, after his blood had cooled, and they heard that the fishers were going to have to pay, Nicky felt, weirdly, like an idiot. It felt like that thing when you tell someone a bit too much, and you feel exposed, and spend the following weeks praying they'll forget what you told them, afraid they might use it against you. And what was the point of putting it out there anyway? The only people who'd want to look at a blog like that were the kind of people who slowed down to look at car crashes. He opened it up at first because he was going to delete it. And then he thought, no, people will have seen it. I'll look even more stupid if I take it down. So he decided to write a short thing about the fishers being evicted, and that would be the end of it. He wasn't going to name them, but he wanted to post something good, so that if anyone ever did come across what he had written, they wouldn't think his whole family were completely tragic. He read through what he'd written the previous week, the emotion and the rawness of it, and his toes actually curled with shame. He wondered who out there in cyberspace had read it. He wondered how many people in the world now thought he was an idiot as well as a freak. And then he reached the bottom, and he saw the comments. "Hang on in there, goth boy. People like that make me sick. Your blog got sent to me by a friend and it made me cry. I hope your dog is okay. Please post and let us know when you get a chance. Hey, Nicky, I'm Victor from Portugal. I don't know you, but my friend linked to your blog on Facebook, and I just wanted to say that I felt like you did a year back, and things did get better. Don't worry. Peace." He scrolled down some more. There was message after message. Kind, helpful, friendly. He put his blog into a search engine. It had been copied and linked hundreds, then thousands of times. Nicky looked at the statistics, then sat back in his chair and stared in disbelief. 2,876 people had read it. In a single week. Almost 3,000 people had read his words. More than 400 of them had taken the trouble to send him a message about it. And only two had called him a wanker. But that wasn't all. People had sent money, actual money. Someone had opened an online donation account to help with the vet's fees because they wanted Norman to be okay, and left a message telling him how he could access it using a PayPal account. "I can't donate enough to put your sister through school, but I can put something towards a new puppy for your sister if your dog doesn't make it. I'm glad she has you. Hey, goth boy, is that your real name? Have you thought of a rescue dog? That way something good might come out of it. I enclose a contribution. Rescue centres always need donations. Cheeky smile. A little something to help with the vet's bills. Give your sister a hug from me. I'm so mad at what happened to you all. My dog got hit by a car and was saved by the PDSA. I'm guessing you don't have one near you. I thought it would be nice, as someone helped me, to help you a little. Please accept my £10 towards his recuperation. From a fellow girl maths geek, please tell your sister to keep on. Don't let them win." It had gone viral. There were 459 shares. Nicky counted 130 names on the donations page, £2 being the smallest donation, and 250 the highest. A total stranger had sent £250. The final tally sat at £932.50, the last having come in an hour previously. He kept refreshing the page and staring at the figure, wondering if they had put a full stop in the wrong place. His heart was doing something really strange. He placed his palm against his chest, wondering if this was what it felt like to have a heart attack. He wondered if he was going to die. What he wanted to do, though, he discovered, was laugh. He wanted to laugh at the magnificence of total strangers, at their kindness and their goodness, and the fact that there were actual people out there being good and nice and giving money to people they had never met and never would. And because, most crazy of all that kindness, All that magnificence was sitting there, just because of his words. Jess was standing by the cupboard holding a parcel of pink tissue when he scooted into the living room. "Here," he said. "Look." He pulled at her arm, dragging her over to the sofa. "What?" "Put that down,"